cutting out every single food under the sun, including like kale, because it had too many oxalates. I mean, there's a rule for every single food until you're left with basically nothing. To the point where I actually followed this one guy at one point who said that like the water coming from pipes was actually dangerous and you needed to. So it was like literally you could find something wrong with everything.
Welcome to Behind the Bite, where we delve deep into the real life struggles and triumphs surrounding food, body, and weight. I'm Dr. Christina Castagnini, a psychologist and certified eating disorder specialist, bringing you a unique blend of personal experience as a recovered individual with over 25 years of professional expertise. In each episode, we'll share the courageous journeys of individuals who have faced these challenges firsthand, alongside insights from dedicated professionals in the field. Whether you're seeking healing, inspiration, or simply a deeper understanding, this podcast is here to empower you on your own path to a better life. Join us as we explore stories of resilience, discuss the latest insights, and strive to foster a community of support and growth. Together, we can break down barriers, challenge stigma, and pave the way towards healing and living authentically. Well, hello, everyone. Welcome to today's show. If you ever felt that jolt of panic when a new quote-unquote health rule hits the internet, like eat this, never eat that, carbs are bad for now, fat's the answer, protein's the only quote-unquote safe food, things like that, then this episode really is for you. Because for so many of us, especially the perfectionists and the people who think like, tell me the right way and I'll do it perfectly people, with calling myself out on that one, public health messaging doesn't land as neutral information. It lands like a moral scoreboard, and it's like a test you can pass or fail. And if you have any history of restriction, binging, bulimia, orthorexia, or just very complicated relationship with food, those messages don't just influence you. They can hijack you. They can completely take over your life. And look, quick disclaimer, today's episode touches on food rules, diet culture, and things like GLP-1 medications, which I have talked about before, but this, again, isn't medical advice, and everything is shared through a recovery-informed lens. So just take care of yourself. If you get triggered, take a break and come back when you feel ready. Today, I'm joined by a really amazing guest, like always. Stephanie Michelle is a binge eating recovery and body image coach who also brings something I value deeply, the lived boots on the ground recovery reality. And she spent 25 years of cycling through restriction, binging, bulimia, orthorexia, until she recovered in her 40s. And she's going to talk more about that. And in our conversation, we're going to unpack what happens when food guidelines and wellness culture get simplified into flashy graphics and fear-based messaging, and how easily that becomes fuel for the eating disorder voice. We're going to talk about this new food pyramid, or the inverted pyramid messaging, and the ways images stick more than nuance, why quote-unquote clean eating can turn into a rabbit hole where everything is dangerous, and how the harder you try to, you know, do it right, say that again in quotes, the more your body can respond with binging, not because you're broken, but because you're human. And yeah, we're going to go there. The intersection of GLP-1s, appetite suppression, rule following, and social permission, and why this combination can be a perfect storm for disordered eating, especially when the culture frames it as health. So if you've been feeling torn, like you know what you value, you want balance, but the pressure still gets inside your head, then please stay with us. Just listen to this whole episode, because this episode isn't about telling you what to eat. It's about helping you hear the difference between nourishment and control and giving you a way back to yourself. So I'm going to go get our guest and we're going to get started. All right. Well, Stephanie, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. I'm glad to be here.
Well, I'm really excited to have you. And as with most guests, I just like to ask a little bit about like you, your background, if you don't mind sharing, like how you got into this field and doing the work you're doing.
Yeah, I'll try to make it short. So I'm a coach and I work with people who struggle with binging and restricting and also body image issues. I got into this work because I myself struggled with those things for 25 years. I was an occupational therapist, but I recovered when I turned 40. And I was like, if I ever actually recover from this, because I never thought that would be possible, that was what I wanted to do. And I wanted to help people. And so I started writing about recovery. I got some coaching certifications. I became certified in somatic therapy, which is a body-based trauma therapy. And now here I am, and this is what I'm the most passionate about. I can't imagine doing anything else.
Awesome. That was very short.
Yeah.
I'm actually curious, like, why did you think you'd never recover?
Because when I was 15, I started to more significantly restrict. I mean, I had been that kind of typical. As an adolescent, I was a little bit more quote unquote bigger boned. That was what my grandma always used to say, than my peers. And so I had always dabbled in like dieting. But when I was 15, I started restricting to the degree that I was diagnosed with anorexia, and then binging about 2 years after that. And it turned into bulimia and then orthorexia. And it was like my identity. It was my lifestyle. I didn't really remember like eating in a way that felt natural or easy. And I tried everything. And I was always, it was like a full-time job for 25 years of trying to recover. I thought about very little else and never could do it. So to me, it was like a glitch in me. I thought it was just the way that I was built, you know, like my appetite was too big. And, you know, I tried so many things emotionally, you know, just different strategies, different therapies, and nothing worked. So to me, it was just like what the rest of my life was going to look like.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, I hear that all the time. People are like, oh, there's no way I'm ever going to fully recover. And I think there's even that myth out there that I hate, you know, it's like, oh, you're never going to fully recover. You're always going to kind of have this disorder with you. And I don't know if you heard that too.
Yeah. Yes. And when I think about my relationship with food now, and I've been recovered now for 6.5 years, so it'll be 7 years, this year. Awesome. I mean, my relationship with food is the most steady thing. I feel no, like even even with body image, sometimes I have like body image moments, right? But with food, it's like there is such a different relationship that I have with it that I can't imagine ever being any different. And that doesn't mean it couldn't be, but just for this period of time, like it's almost like once you see the man behind the curtain, I could never unsee it. And it was a lot of that ended up, you know, becoming part of how I healed and how I recovered, was like understanding things differently. Mm-hmm. And that part I can't unlearn. So to me, it feels like, you know, just something that I do feel fully recovered.
Awesome. Yeah. I just love having people on here saying that, because I know there's probably people listening. They're like, oh, come on.
Yeah, I know.
No way.
I know. I get it. And I've talked to other people and, you know, who do say that they don't necessarily feel fully recovered. And I respect that. And I can understand why that is. So I wouldn't want to say like, oh, I did it, so everyone can do it. You know, right. I understand everyone has different resources and situations, but it is possible to fully recover. I stand by that.
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely. I'm glad, you know, you said that, and thank you for sharing your journey. And, you know, I even think people think, oh, once you're a certain age, you can't recover either, or you've been doing it for so long. So,
I was 40. It was one of those things where I was turning, well, when I say I recovered when I was 40, it was literally like one day I did an all-in kind of process for recovery. So it wasn't like a slow and gradual uncovering of, or like an, you know what I mean? It was like, I'm going to stop compensating for the food that I'm eating, because that was really what was keeping that cycle alive. And I started doing that specifically, like on purpose, starting actually on my 40th birthday. Mm-hmm. And it was because I was like, I'm going to be 40. And when I turned 30, I told myself I was going to not be here at the, you know, 10 years later. And here I am. And when I turned 20, I said the same thing. And every single birthday was always the year I was going to recover. And then it never was. So by the time I was 40, I was like, I'm going to be like this until I'm turning 80. You know, like this is just going to continue if something doesn't change.
Well, and you're right. Everyone has their own trajectory and their own path. And so, you know, but I guess to the point of, you can be doing it for decades and it's never too late. So
yeah, definitely.
So let's talk about food, because that's the topic of our conversation today. And, you know, I love to hear a little bit more about your thoughts on the new food guidelines and pyramid. Is, I don't even know if we call it a pyramid anymore, whatever it is.
Inverted pyramid. Yeah. I think right. That's what they're saying.
Or maybe we even talk about like the one that was there for so long and like the shift and change now and the impact you think it's all going to have.
Well, so I'm not a nutritionist, so I leave that to the experts, but I grew up with the food pyramid, the original food pyramid. Mm-hmm. And what's so interesting and, you know, is that they've sort of branded this new inverted pyramid, which prioritizes proteins and fats over carbs. Now, if you actually read it, it's a different, the graphic that they put out there looks very different than the actual write-up of it. But it, when you look at the image, which is what most people do, it really looks like it looks like low carb. I mean, that's really what it looks like. And so anybody who's kind of using the imagery, which most people are doing, they're not reading through the actual guidelines most of the time, right? So that imagery is what's going to stick. And it just to me like screams, like diet just reminds me of like my low carb days, my Atkins diet, the keto, you know, kind of principles and all of the things that I got into like 10 years ago with, like obsession with clean eating and health and things like that. And how that actually really destroyed my relationship with food. But the food pyramid was actually, hasn't been in use since, what was it, 2011, I think. So this idea that it's like inverted it and it's changed the food pyramid, it actually, that was updated a long time ago. And so it's, there's a lot of marketing and around this idea that they've sort of turned. So the image that people will see and really take home isn't what the details actually spell out, but more like the impression that we should be eating a lot of protein and fat and very little carbs. And if I'd looked at that 10 years ago, you know, I would have just felt all the shoulds come upon me, right? Because it's not necessarily a quote unquote balanced idea. It's quite extreme in that it significantly reduces carbohydrates, at least in the image.
Yeah. And I was thinking the same thing. I remember like, you know, I was so obsessed with like doing everything perfectly when I was disordered. And I remember like, whether it was looking at the food pyramid or whatever I looked at the time, just adhering to everything to such a degree that like, I thought, gosh, if I looked at this now, it would just not only validate like low carb or no carb is like the thing, which is, we can talk about how scary that is, but like, where did this even come from? Why is this okay?
It's interesting because so in 2014-ish, I was still very deep in my disorder, but I had had my second daughter. I have three girls, but it was my second pregnancy after that I became really obsessed with like healthy eating. So up until then, it was always mostly about like what was going to be the least amount of calories, what was going to keep me the thinnest. But after I actually got diagnosed with chronic Lyme disease, and I had somebody tell me, oh, you should go off of gluten and dairy. And at that point I was like, oh, okay, you know, like, and let me try that. And it became this whole rabbit hole of like cutting out every single food under the sun, including like kale, because it had too many oxalates. I mean, there's a rule for every single food until you're left with basically nothing. To the point where I actually followed this one guy at one point who said that like the water coming from pipes was actually dangerous and you needed to, so it was like literally you could find something wrong with everything. And a lot of the stuff that was really popular then, and a lot of the people who are behind the RFK, you know, like who are with RFK on this, you know, pushing this, were people that I really used to follow a lot back then. And there's so much moralization of food in those spheres, like tons. I don't know if you're familiar with Food Babe, the Food Babe.
No, tell me.
Okay. So she's one of these people that I followed. I mean, I went to see her speak in like 2015, 2016, who teaches her children that like processed food is poison and she's not afraid to tell them that it's poison. And there's a lot of people behind this. Like, but what it is taking, you know, kind of like something that's saying, okay, there's some nutritionally dense foods and then there's some foods that aren't as nutritionally dense, which is okay, that's fair. But it's taking that and making it bad and good in this very sensationalist way. Mm-hmm. And then throwing it out to the public or to your kids or to whoever and scaring people into thinking that they're committing a mortal sin if they have a processed food. And that's what this whole thing feels like to me. It feels like the co-signing on that kind of sensationalism that is very much supported by the people supporting this. And it's just so interesting to me because I'm like, this is so 10 years ago. It's like such a flashback for me of everything that was going on in the functional medicine world back then. And the things that really got me in trouble back then and made my eating disorder that much worse.
Yeah. It's kind of this fear, right? Like if you eat the wrong things and you have a diagnosis of something, like,
yeah,
it's good. Yeah. You're responsible for making yourself sick or not. Yes. Or not getting better. Right.
Yes. And the stress of that, like, does so much more harm than the food is. I couldn't cure myself from the symptoms I had of Lyme disease with food and exercise and cold plunges or any of it. Not that any of those things are, like, nutrition's not a bad thing and exercise is not a bad, these things aren't bad, but it's just, they're not necessarily, you know, the way that they're talked about is like, you have to do it exactly this way and there's no exceptions and everything, you know, is disordered. You know, and it feeds disorder and that feeds stress. And then that stress, what is that stress doing to us? You know, especially with people with chronic illnesses, right? Like we know for sure that stress is one of the indicators of like, you know, it's one of the health behavior, you know, it's one of the, it impacts health. It impacts health really strongly. And that's been studied, mm-hmm. but it's kind of disregarded in this, you know, it's just about the food and the morals instead of, you know, the stress.
You know, I don't know what you feel, but I hear this all the time. Like there's such a criticism of Americans and like the way we eat and our food. And it's like, it's so derogatory and it's almost like we're getting chastised and blamed for like,
yeah,
like we're so bad. And, yeah. And I don't know if this is a result of that, like, oh, you know, Americans are gluttonous and this and that and whatever, like their food's so bad and, you know, everyone else eats so much better and this and that. But I don't know if this kind of came out of that to like,
yeah,
counter that, but it just seems like, I don't know. I don't know. It, to your point, it's like this morality thing and almost this pressure of like having to eat a certain way or else you blame yourself. Like I'm the one responsible for if I get an illness or a disease or I didn't eat right. Or I mean, I've worked in the health field for so long. I hear people say like, oh, did I cause this diagnosis of XYZ because I ate all these foods or I didn't eat right or whatever. And it's like, and then people get diagnosed and I've seen a lot of people like, okay, how do I eat so that I can get healthy or I can prevent this from getting worse or cure it or whatever it is.
Well, the irony of that, especially working with people who have disordered eating disorders, binge eating being one of the most, I work with that population the most. Mm-hmm. And it's like the harder you try to do the right thing, the more, the worse the binge eating gets. And the irony of that, like, I understand too that there are some people who don't have disordered eating and don't have eating disorders and sort of move through nutritional guidance without developing a problem, right? But there are so many people who take nutritional advice like Bible. And it, again, to your point earlier, like it has to be done in this perfectionistic way. And then that is essentially restriction for them, right? Like that they're eating smaller amounts than they need because there's that morality too. They're not eating carbohydrates where we need carbohydrates, or they're sort of foregoing any kind of processed foods because we're told that it's dangerous, even though processed foods are all around. And we can't underestimate the psychological impact of saying no, of never being allowed to have something that's right in front of you all the time. And that reads to the body as restriction, which you can do for some time before it breaks. And then there's this like, you know, this mass consumption. And then that becomes the thing that we're like, oh, what's wrong with me that I binge, that I can't have this willpower, instead of seeing it as, oh, that was just the cause of everything that came before it. All that restriction that was happening, all that rule following without flexibility is actually funneling right into these binges, and that's the cycle, and that the more flexibility that we have, the better our relationship to food gets. And that people I hear all the time saying, like, I feel like I'm damaging my health because I'm having all of these binges on all of this food, and this isn't healthy. But not connecting that to the restriction not being healthy, that's part of what is causing the imbalance.
Exactly. And I mean, where's the science behind this, that we don't need carbs as our primary source of fuel? And that's what I think where I'm getting at too. And I know we're both not nutritionists, but.
Yeah, I know.
It's perpetuating, to your point, all this low carb, no carb, keto stuff that's like very diety, and it scares me.
I don't know the mechanisms of this exactly, but like, I also think that we need carbohydrates, especially for our hormones as women. And so the idea that men are saying, eat steak and beef tallow, and not any potatoes or whatever, is a very different thing than for a woman to not eat those things, who need the carbohydrates, in the reproductive years, right, when that's even more important. And that, I don't think that, that that's looked at. I don't think that's even considered or discussed. I think it's just, it's almost like, I think this wellness culture is this elevated, it's almost like a superiority or a hierarchy of, it's like a status symbol, really, to eat in these certain ways and to get all of these fancy treatments and regulate your nervous system this way and that way. And again, these things aren't necessarily bad, but they're more status symbols than anything else. And I think that the idea of actual balance being part of something that is federally propagated to kids and to, to Americans is, it's dangerous. It's dangerous to just sort of go on a whim with this and to use something that's more of a wellness culture niche as actual standard of living for everybody.
Very true. And because if you're talking about sources of proteins and things, it's much more expensive to buy protein for nourishment and then other sources of fuel. And now we're, to your point, was everyone thinking about not everyone has equal access to food and sources of food. And now they're getting nuanced into, okay, what kind of protein are you eating? Are you eating organic, non-hormone, meats and things like that? Or we're going to get into the weeds here.
but that's an excellent point. Because it is sort of it has to be grass-fed, it has to be organic, it has to be non-GMO, and we could even debate what that even means. I don't think there's anything wrong with a grass-fed meat, but it's very expensive. And to your point, the access here and the way that it's being portrayed as irresponsible to not be eating in a certain way that simply is actually not affordable. I went to Costco last weekend and now they're selling beef tallow, which they have never carried before. And now they're selling it in these big jug, these big jars. And it's not cheap. And that, if that becomes something that's it's the ignorance of Americans and, this is what people need, education and awareness. But it's also they also need the money to be able to buy these things. It's not very accessible to most people. And I think it's just causing, it's actually this creating more of a class gap, and that's maybe, I don't know. It's it just feels with the way this world is running right now, maybe that's kind of the point. I don't know if that's part of the way that this all works, but it just feels very ignorant in so many ways, what's happening here.
Yeah, it does. And I'm worried about the health effects, number one, but also, I don't know. My head is spinning. There's just so many things. Yeah. I'm sorry. There are. And also, I don't remember the food pyramid ever discussing ultra-processed foods. And it's when I was listening to it first coming out, I was they're talking about not having processed foods and ultra processed foods. I'm I don't ever remember the food pyramid incorporating those things.
Right. They were five servings of processed foods a day, five servings of fruits and vegetables. That's a good point. That is actually a great point as well. I just had a thought. That's the piece too, is like, it puts the onus on the consumer, right, to do that. And it's like the systems of food would need to change before we could make different choices on these things. So, you know, you're right. It says like carbohydrates, like that's the servings of carbohydrates or whatever it is, how you get those carbohydrates is different. I think in the fine print of the guidelines, like they do more explicitly state, you know, the stuff about ultra processed foods versus like whole grains and getting things, you know, like where those sources of carbs are coming from. And they talk about that, but it can't go to the individual before it goes to the systems. And so if the way that people can afford food is through packaged foods and fast foods and things like that, then that's what's going to be accessible to them. And then we can't have guidelines that are saying, well, that's not okay. I think the systems might need revamping, but that can't come to the consumer first, because we have no way of being able to access certain things, or if we can access these other things, it becomes restrictive to not have, you know, to be saying that we can't have these foods that are actually all around and marketed to us every day, you know, because that's going to feel like a psychological, like there might be a psychological rebellion to that. And then of course we're thinking that it's our fault.
Yeah. I'm just trying to think about what this does for someone who's so disordered and thinking, I'm not going to get enough carbohydrates because I'm told I can't eat them and I'm going to adhere to this. Your brain's not going to function and think clearly.
Yeah.
And then I don't know. I'm very interested to see how this all plays out. I'm scared. Yeah. I'm nervous. I'm worried about people not eating enough to fuel their bodies, especially if they're athletes, they're active, just in general, hormonally for kids growing up.
Yeah. That's the scary part too. Like with the kids that this is being touted. I wonder too, if like with the availability of GLP-1s, that it's like the combination of these things is really manufacturing eating disorders, because you've got the reduction of appetite and then you've got these rules that makes those rules a lot easier to follow, because there's a natural suppression of appetite. So maybe then they're not feeling the hunger for the carbohydrates or the whatever. And what that does long-term. And, you know, I, that's a scary thought to think about what kind of, what nutritional damage gets done when you are not only reducing a major macronutrient, but also reducing appetite that would cue you to eating that what you need and getting that macronutrient that you wouldn't even feel it. I mean, it would have sounded like a dream to me 10 years ago, to be honest. Like that would have been exactly what I would have signed up for. But the point is that was very much in a disordered place. You know, so it's co-signing on a lot of the disorder, I think.
Well, I think, you know, I've been hearing a lot of noise about like how many people are in, you know, their disorder or don't even know that they have disordered eating, but they're being prescribed GLP-1s unbeknownst to their medical providers. And this is just giving them like a free pass, if you will, to engage in it. And now with the guidelines saying, oh, now I have like the buy-in from the government saying, I don't need to eat carbs. This is great. This is confirming everything I've been doing. And now I'm being told it's quote unquote healthy and it's what I'm supposed to be doing. The eating disorder voice must just be like, yay.
Yeah.
Like, exactly. I'm given permission. See, it's healthy. I was right all along.
Exactly.
And,
we both did it at the same time. Yeah, exactly. And that's, I mean, at that point, that feels like the work we do, right? Like to be balancing that, you know, and questioning that and even looking to science, you know, and that's what the nutritionists are for. And I follow so many excellent non-diet nutritionists on Instagram and on other social media platforms who are speaking to this very intelligently and getting the science and actually pulling the science and just even basic things to tell people, to tell their followers, like this is the way, this is what we need. These are the basic nutritional wisdom, you know, this is what we need to know. And it becomes, maybe it becomes like a, in the world of social media where like influence just depends on who you follow, it kind of can depend on who you follow at that point. And there will be those who subscribe even further to what's going on out there. And there will be those who hear otherwise. And it's, you know, it's like, yeah, it's this perfect storm almost of like the things going on and the GLP-1s and the social media and the way that our culture is really changing so much due to the way that we're influenced now, mm-hmm. not just what's true or what's studied. It's just what people are saying or what people are the misinformation out there and how that gets passed along.
And you know what I love about having you on as a guest is like, you've been through recovery. You've been through all the disorder. You coach people, right? So it's like, you and I aren't just talking about this like it's some lofty thing and like we're just having opinions because we think, oh, we just want to be contrary to what's out there. You know, so I'd love to hear a little bit more about like maybe the people you've coached and like, I mean, I could talk at length about the people that I've seen restrict carbohydrates and think this is the best thing. And my doctors told me this and that, you know, even back in the day were prescribed Fen-Phen and things like that. all the things. And, you know, when they started going through recovery and introducing carbohydrates back as their main fuel source and all the things, and their brain got back online and they could think coherently and engage in therapy. And they were like a human again. And they had laughter and they were like, oh my gosh. And they got their life back. So I'm coming at this from like almost 30 years of watching people, including myself, like re-engage in life because they fueled themselves properly with carbohydrates as their main source. I'm not just saying this because I'm like, oh, I want to be like anti-diet and like this. It's just true.
Yeah. I can, like, that happened yesterday when I was talking to a client. A lot of the people I've worked with who are restrictive and who limit their carbohydrates and or their calories, so they're not getting enough carbohydrates just by virtue of not getting enough calories of them. You know, there's always a certain period of time of like working, and I meet somebody where they are. So sometimes like there's a working up to being able to eat more of these things. So sometimes I'm watching from the beginning, somebody who is undernourished and not eating carbs much at all, or not eating enough of them, move towards eating more and incorporating more and incorporating more. And the one thing that just, and this happened yesterday in a call where somebody had a dinner the night before of plenty of carbohydrates. Mm-hmm. And when she showed up to the call the next morning, she was like sitting back in her chair in where she normally was like, you know, she's usually like sitting very forward and feeling really, really anxious. And she's like, I just feel slower, like in a positive way. She's like, I feel like I can think. I feel like I can hear my own thoughts. I feel like I can like the things that felt like a really big deal 2 months ago, like just feels more like, yeah, like it feels figure outable now. It feels like less of a big deal. I feel like I'm paying attention to things and like just the almost like the balm of it, like for a nourished body to become the way I talk about it is like regulated, you know what I mean? Because it's essentially to be dysregulated if you're not getting what you need, if your body is in a state of like, I don't have enough of a thing that I need to function. And so it's going to be in an emergency state. And that's what creates that anxiety and or depression and numbness and absence and brain fog. And then that with the onset, with having carbohydrates, that like, it's a shift in the actual nervous system. And that's part of the way that I think about food, like that we really have to regulate from the bottom up. And that if we're not getting the adequate nourishment, then all of these fancy tools, you know, again, in the wellness space, that's really big. Like even like meditation or yoga or, you know, cryotherapy and acupuncture, like that these things can't regulate a dysregulated nervous system. That's not just simply not getting enough carbohydrates, like the simplicity of that. Yeah. And that, you know, my own life changed when I ate enough and I never was so anxious except when I was eating low carb and fasting. That was the other one. Like those two things made me a different version of myself that like I could not, it was actually what ended up spurring my recovery because I got to a point of eating low carb and fasting too. And I just was like, I can't do this anymore. Like, this is not something that I can sustain. And I'm actually willing to gain weight if I have to get, you know, to get away from the way this feels. Mm. Which was a good thing in the end for me, because it did sort of send me on my way. But yeah, like carbohydrates are one of the they're a macronutrient. We need them for our brain function.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think people forget too, if you don't eat enough carbs, the thing that you're trying to prevent ends up happening, which is, you know, our bodies are amazing. They want to stay alive, and they will grab fuel from your muscle. Like, yeah. It needs glycogen, which is carbohydrates, right? It needs that as its main fuel source. So it will take it from where it will find it, and they will grab it from your muscle, which, you know, people are like, I need to build muscle, I need this. And so you don't realize you are atrophying, or like you're breaking down your muscle if you don't eat enough carbohydrates.
Yeah.
People forget that. And I think that's what's happening with GLP-1s is you're breaking down the muscle.
Definitely. And I think, you know, there's a way that those are used responsibly, and then there's a way that they're not. And I think that when you're in disorder and you're using whatever you can to further your disorder, whether that's a medication or the food pyramid or the inverted food pyramid, that, you know, it's not, it's more a desperation, you know, it becomes another symptom, not a way of helping yourself. I don't know. Again, we'll see in years how this plays out. And in the meantime, we'll just keep talking about it.
Yeah. I mean, I think there needs to be continued conversation just to like make people aware, to think like, is this something I want to adhere to or like not? And like, just, I don't think there's a lot of questioning sometimes when things come out of like, this is the best thing to do. It's just, okay, this is what I'm told. My doctor's saying it's healthy.
Yeah. Yes, that's true. I've worked with a lot of clients who have, you know, just sort of rely on what the going, you know, they're not, obviously we're not in the, you know, scientific journals and things like that. And a lot of the going narrative on things is like eat less carbs, especially people who are diagnosed with insulin resistance or PCOS, you know, and obviously in pre-diabetes, which is more and more diagnosed. And so it's kind of like, I now have to reduce carbs. I got my blood work back and now I'm pre-diabetic and now I have to not eat carbs, right? Like that this is just what their doctors tell them, because that's just, and that's been true before the change of the food pyramid or of the food guidelines. But that there's ways, and there's people, you know, talking about how to, there's lots of non-diet dietitians who intersect with pre-diabetes and with things like that, that help make something more flexible. Cause again, what ends up happening is that it becomes an extreme diet essentially. Mm-hmm. And it just feels like it's done in the name of health, which it is, but the, you know, how that's actually being handled and what the information really shows around how we can live a balanced life. We can have a healthy body incorporating all foods, is something I think that's the job of these nutritionists.
Mm-hmm. So I'm actually just curious your thoughts. Like if you were to predict what things look like in 10 years with all these changes with GLP-1s, the food guidelines, what do you think might, what might we be dealing with or talking about in 10 years if you come back on the show?
Oh, I worry about that. I have thought to myself like that in 10 years, I don't know about five. If you'd said five, I don't know. I think the bubble might last that at least that long, but in 10, I think that we'll be looking at an explosion in eating disorders. I think that it will become, I'm worried. It's either one of two ways. I'm either like, there's going to be more work than I know what to do with, or it will become so normalized, you know, that like now, like it's almost like this socially sanctioned thing. And that's what's happening more and more and more. And that, you know, I don't know what that means for the way that we, like, if we're a collective nation of brain fog, you know, and that if this continues the way that it is. But I do think that eating disorders will rise. How often they're going to get diagnosed, I don't know, because again, of the normalization of it. But I think there will be more and more people suffering. And I tend to believe that like something that is in an extreme or in a bubble can only last so long. So I do have this hope that there will be some common sense that arrives at some point. That's the hope anyway. That's what I hope.
Yeah, I'm with you. I'm embracing myself, you know. I'm already, you know, seeing things where people are coming out saying some of the effects they're having from all of this. And I'm just, to your point, like going, I don't know, it might even be 5 years. Who knows?
Yeah, I mean, could be. I'm just like thinking, you know, a lot of things can work for about 5 years, you know, and then the tides change, or, you know, the symptoms start coming up. And I think I'm mostly concerned about like the combination effect of these things and what's, you know, the compounding variables of all of it together and what it really endorses. But I also think that things that become imbalanced for too long have a way of coming back into balance and, you know, sort of what's that phrase? It's like the equal and opposite reactions kind of thing. So I guess I hold hope for that. I hold hope for that. And you know what? Also, I have worked with a lot of clients who, despite the advice out there and despite the influencers and the way that, you know, these things are being talked about, that they can think for themselves and they can think like, this doesn't feel right to me. This doesn't feel like a path I want to follow. And there was a non-diet, you know, or more discussion about intuitive eating and things like that pre, you know, that had a lead up, it had a little bit of a run, and it's in the mainstream conversation. So there's people who are still aware of it and still pursuing it, despite the fact that it becomes harder and harder against a culture that continues to push and push and push against, you know, for the opposite. But I don't think everybody is convinced. I guess I'll put it that way.
Yeah, I'm with you. And I think the more conversations we have, the more people like you out there putting things out, maybe, you know, people will find help, they'll find community. And I do think that it's not sustainable. So hopefully people will, you know, not engage in these things. And I do think that, I have a number of people who are like, I don't think this is feasible. I don't want to do it. But I do think people are stressed out and they're feeling the pressure. Yeah. And they're, unfortunately, there's been a lack of wanting to go to the doctors because they're hearing all the noise and the pressure of like, you know, you're not healthy because X, Y, Z, you need to do.
Yeah.
That's my other fear, is just that part.
Yep. Definitely. I had that happened this week too. I have a client who wants to go to a cardiologist and is afraid of the weight stigma there. But again, that's also been around for a long time.
It has.
Yeah.
Well, oh my gosh. Lots of things to come. Hopefully it's not as, you know, bad as maybe we're bracing ourselves for, but I'm really glad we had the discussion because it's all so new. We have no idea what's actually going to happen, but I just think it's worth having the discussion and hearing your thoughts on it.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah. Any last final words before we end?
Oh boy. My whole, my area of passion around this is that like you make sense. And so if you are somebody who's been feeling stressed out about this, like even that makes sense, because what comes down the chain feels like truth, even if you have values otherwise, right? Like, and even if you can say, oh, I've been listening to this podcast or that podcast, and I understand that this might not be the best thing for me, but why do I feel this kind of pressure and that I still feel torn about it? I still have these old voices in my head. That also makes sense, you know, because it's being endorsed. And so to just kind of, again, meet yourself where you are and to just keep listening, I think it's the exposure to various voices that help us figure out where we personally need to be, rather than just following extreme voices in the world, which are getting louder on one side of a spectrum right now. So to continue just like gaining awareness and believing, you know, and having compassion for yourself around this.
Okay. So people want to find you, work with you. How can they do that?
I am Stephanie Michelle. Like, that is my actual website. I am Stephanie Michelle, .com is my website. I have, some self-paced courses there. I'm going to be starting a community really soon. I also am active on Instagram, and I have a podcast called, Full But Not Finished, which is available on YouTube as well. So you can join me there too.
Well, thank you again so much. It's been such a pleasure. I love hearing everything you have to say, and we'll go follow her on Instagram. It's a great profile, and she's got a lot of great content. So
thanks.
All right. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for listening today. Behind the Bite podcast is created by me, Dr. Christina Castanini, as part of the Los Angeles Tribune Podcast Network and produced by the Tweaky Tales. I love hearing from my listeners. So if you like the show, please like, rate, and subscribe to it on whatever platform you're on. And for anyone who wants to understand their relationship with food better, or who might be wondering if they have an eating disorder, I have a free 9-week e-course at my website. Just go to www.behindthebitepodcast.com to get your free e-course today. Please note, this podcast is designed to provide accurate and authoritative information in regard to the subject matter covered. It is given with the understanding that neither host, the publisher, or the guests are rendering legal, clinical, or other professional information. If you want or need a professional, you should find one to work with who can address your individual needs and situation.